Hello and welcome to AstroTalk UK. AT UK is a not-for-profit 30-minute weekly audio podcast primarily for and by amateur astronomers in the UK. Available only online, AT UK is a virtual meeting point for the amateur astronomy community. Each episode is an MP3 file which can be downloaded automatically with a free subscription via one of the many podcast readers. I use iTunes. My name is Gurbir Singh, and I host AT UK. I am not a scientist, nor am I an astronomer. Topics of discussion have no fixed boundaries other than their relevance to amateur astronomy. Each week's episode consists of pre-recorded conversations with individuals discussing the roles, lives, and achievements of amateur astronomers and their hobby. More about AT UK at www.astrotalkuk.org. If you have a topic for discussion, drop me a note on info@astrotalkuk.org. AstroTalk UK, amateur astronomy, expert opinion. Episode 3, Sunday, February the 17th, 2008. In today's episode, David Levy, one of the most prolific comet discoverers, 22 to date, including the famous Shoemaker-Levy 9, which provided not only a spectacle of truly astronomical proportions back in 1994, but a unique opportunity to conduct fundamental planetary science. Alison Gibbings from the UK SEDS stand at Astrofest, students for the exploration of space, explained that you don't actually have to be a student to join UK SEDS. But first, light pollution. Earlier this week, you may have seen some stories in the press about Buckinghamshire Council switching off street and road lights after midnight, something that was common back in the 60s and 70s. Why? Well, they want to help out the local amateur astronomers, of course. Well, actually, something more prosaic and noble. They want to save some money and the planet. How successful they and other councils are, we'll have to wait and see. The Campaign for Dark Skies has been urging this response for decades. During Astrofest, David Paul from the BAA's Campaign for Dark Skies explains when the campaign started.
It's almost 20 years ago, actually over 20 years ago, about 1987, 88. It was set up to fight the rising problem of light pollution in the 80s. Mm. I think it suddenly got worse in the 70s, and by the 80s there was a realisation this was getting rapidly worse.
And it really is a national campaign now.
Oh yes, we're part of the British Astronomical Association. We have about over 100 local offices all over the country, from Scotland, you know, to Ireland, all over Britain. I'm a local officer for Essex, and also, as you said, I'm on the national committee as well, which is which is all the policy for the campaign.
And does every local area have an officer like you?
Pretty much, yeah. There's a few pockets in the country where there's less population, but perhaps less light pollution anyway.
Right.
But yeah, there's two in Essex, for example. There's North Essex, South Essex.
We're interested in this because of the detrimental conditions to the observing for us amateur astronomers. Do you think over the last 20 years or so since you've been around, things have got better?
Better and worse. If we hadn't been around, it would have been far worse. So it's been a question of containment. There are some big successes the last few years. The biggest success has probably been with the Highways Agency. 20 years ago, the head of the Orange low-pressure sodium lighting, which, you know, probably 30% of the light is up into the sky. You'll now find almost every motorway is flat glass lighting. It's contained, puts light onto the ground. And the last 3 years, we've had a direct dialogue with the Highways Agency and even consulted on their standards. The latest standards came out this year are even better. And it's all about CO2 reduction and saving energy as well. So, and environment, local, you know, a lot of animals are nocturnal, for example. If you contain the light onto the road, a lit road can actually be a barrier to nightlife. They won't actually cross the road.
You mentioned this success with highways agencies. Are there any other civil authorities that you have been interacting with?
Yes, there's a trial happening at the moment. I wouldn't say I take credit for this, but Essex County Council have been doing a part-time light switch off after midnight, so midnight until 5 a.m. where the outskirts of towns and villages, say 50% of a town or a village, will get turned off, just like it was in the old days, you know, the 60s, 70s. That's how it used to be when I was little. Maldon, Saffron Walden and Great Dunmow in Essex are being trialled at the moment. And the intention is, it's very likely that will go county-wide. And it, mainly because the huge rise in energy costs, also reducing CO2. Obviously, there's an offshoot to that is, of course, the light pollution. But we have a very good relationship with Essex County Council. Hertfordshire, I believe, are trying to do the same. Buckinghamshire have trials already. I think Norfolk is doing it or looking at doing it. And beyond that, of course, the next level would be to look at dimming, like, you know, technology to dim lights. So, you know, I think the Highways Agency is looking at this too. So, for example, you know, when traffic's busy or when the weather's worse, you could have super intelligent lighting that only lit when you needed it.
Right.
But it's all about energy and CO2 reduction. This is where we've had the most success recently, because that's real, and everyone's concerned about that, yeah.
Congratulations on that. What about the area of planning? Do you think there's any scope there for the future for these huge lighting projects that some city centres have, where they light big buildings from the floor looking up?
There's a big concern we have at the moment, because we've been trying to influence the planning system. There was something called Planning Policy Statement 23, PPS 23, which would have put the onus on local authorities to have light pollution as a pollution of the water course. You'd also be looking at lighting. But there's a government thinking going on at the moment to relax all the planning laws completely. So currently being consulted on some draft bill out, which is going to undo all this if we're not careful. So planning regulations are essential, because if you leave it to the free market, as you said, you will get free rein. So many industrial estates have lights on all night long. They're badly orientated lighting. They're not put in by professional lighting engineers. They're just put in by cowboys. There's no control over this. We need to legislate.
And I noticed that the National Committee officer has been involved in a consultative role in many of the, I suppose, urban, certainly on the highways agencies. So that's a really strong mark of recognition for the work you've been doing.
Yeah, I think we're not a professional body, but we're almost treated as a semi-professional. And we've just done a report to the Royal Commission. Now there's a Royal Commission looking into the light pollution. Mm-hmm. But our biggest problem is probably apathy, because talking to the astronomical community, a lot of people think you can't do anything about things. And if we'd have thought that 20 years ago, we'd have been in a much worse situation today. You can do things, but you do it through persuasion. There's lots of benefits in fighting light pollution. It's not just about astronomy.
So, amateur astronomers, what sort of things can they be doing right now?
Well, for example, maybe they can encourage their local authorities to take some of the leads like Essex has done. Some councils say they won't do it, it's too much of a risk. Well, Essex is doing it. If one can do it, another one can do it. They should be talking to local industry about reducing their carbon footprint. You know, well, supermarket car parks lit all night long. Even if the supermarket's on all night long, do you need to light the whole car park? It attracts youth at night, you know, vandalism. Why not turn 90% of it off and just leave a local area lit? Approach the places that sell, the retailers sell bad lighting for, you know, bad quality garden lighting, 500 watt lighting when you, for 50 watt light would do. You have to attack all these areas.
And you're saying that rather than the traditional approach of providing lighting to deter vandals, it can have the opposite effect, and if you don't light something, it's actually safer.
Well, lighting can reduce crime, but not necessarily. You'd have to do it intelligently. If there's no observers around, for example, if you've got an out-of-town industrial estate, there's no one around, but lighting a place up could actually help the villain. That there's in California, the whole campuses have been unlit. The light has been turned off, and the vandalism has reduced probably 90%. In some areas, sure, it will help, only where you need it, really. Obviously, in the city centres where people are walking around, of course, people want to have lights. Mm-hmm. But if there's no one to see a crime, if there's no observers, really, what are you actually doing? You're probably helping the criminal in the first place.
Mm. OK, so in addition to writing to your MP, I suppose we can all be doing things at home, lighting in the garage and so on?
Yeah, for example, how many people have outside porch lights that are left on? They come home from work, it's 6 o'clock in the evening, in the winter, the lights on from all night long. Maybe they'll turn it off when they go to bed, but does it need to be on? Garden lighting is also, there's a big trend towards garden lighting, and you light up the garden at night and you're going to deter a lot of animals. Insects, for example, a street light is a massive, it's like a vacuum cleaner to insects. If you kill the insects, insects stick to lights, you kill thousands of insects with street lights, then that's the food chain for the birds. So the whole food chain starts at the micro level, and lighting is decimates the insect population.
So, it seems to be an all-round win-win situation. You've got good environmental benefits, you save money in your bills, and you reduce the carbon footprints. I understand the Campaign for Dark Skies not particularly funded in any way. How do you survive financially? How do you make it all work?
There has been a few sponsors. We do get some money, but it's on an occasional basis. We largely, or almost entirely, rely on the goodwill of the public. We get a small subsidy from the BAA, but obviously BAA is not a huge organisation. So we ran raffles at Astrofest on a few years and got funds by, you know, raffling donated equipment, for example. But we could do with more help. I mean, there's certain elements of industry that ought to us, really.
And for amateur astronomers listening, if they want to support you...
The immediate thing that you could do is... do a newsletter. I think it's currently about £2.40, just for every quarter. You just write, look on our website, Campaign for Dark Skies, and you could get a regular newsletter. You could offer to become a local officer, and then really help.
Okay, so if somebody from AstroTalk UK wants to get involved or even donate, what's the website address, or should they just go to the BAA website and get your link from there?
If you go to the BAA website, there'll be a section in there referencing the Campaign for Dark Skies.
David Paul from Campaign for Dark Skies, thank you very much indeed.
Okay, thank you.
Students for the Exploration of Space was kick-started at MIT and Princeton, but now has branches all over the world. The UK branch organises speakers and visits along the lines that many amateur astronomical societies do. Alison Gibbings from the UK SEDS stand at Astrofest explained that you don't actually have to be a student to join UK SEDS. Alison, what's UK SEDS all about for people who don't know?
It's a wonderful organisation aimed at promoting space and all space-related activities to students, not just like graduates and postgraduates, but anybody interested in space, young, old, or, you know, a little bit wiser. We organise sort of national and international conferences, the main one being our annual conference, which we hold in November, and then we also have a number of branches, which are scattered around between 7 and 8 local universities that organise events. So it's a great way of getting involved, seeing what's involved in the space industry, activities, research, areas where you can get involved and just create an exchange for ideas, concepts, and just to get to know each other.
And that's open not just to students then?
Yes, anybody can join, young, old. If you're an enthusiast, if you're a professional, if you're a researcher, we're open to anybody. All are welcome.
What's your background? You're a postgrad now?
I've just graduated from Kingston University. I've just finished my master's in aerospace engineering. And I've spent the summer working at NASA Goddard on the James Webb Space Telescope. And I'm currently working at Logica CMG and possibly postdoced further industry experience.
I understand you've got a space conference coming up in March next month.
Yes, it's called the UK Space Conference. It's from March the 27th to the 29th, and a 3-day event at Charterhouse School in Godalming, Surrey. And we have speakers, workshops, exhibitions, basically to get all aspects of the space industry together, talking, presenting, discussion. We have four primarily research, well, parallel sessions that are going on, sort of history of space, research and industry, commercial experiences, and sort of students and education. And you can come and mix, meet loads of people, get involved. We have keynote speakers from Joe Ingle, who's a NASA astronaut, David Willem, Director General of the BNSC, who will be doing a policy discussion with basically anybody and anybody that wants to talk about policy. David Southhood, who's the Director of Science at ESA, so he's doing a two-hour discussion panel on Saturday. On Saturday the 29th, we also have UK Says Careers Fair / Opportunities Day, where we're having a careers fair for all the sort of industries and research organisations that are looking for opportunities either as PhDs, further courses, or recent graduates or sort of graduates that are coming up, see what jobs are available, where you could, you know, acquire skills and knowledge and just basically get everybody together.
Oh, sounds terrific. The workshops, what sort of workshops do you anticipate having there?
We've got several. The first one is like a rocket workshop for school children. It's from 14 to 16 and it's run by UCRA. And they're just basically having the finals, so they're going to launch water rockets. SEDS is also running our Lunar Rover Planetary Competition, where we've invited basically our local UK members and our international SEDS members to design lunar rovers, and they're presenting their results at this conference, which will be shortlisted. And we also have this thing called the Masters of the Universe, which is over the three-day conference. Each evening there's a competition. It'll be a pub quiz, building Lego rovers, launching rockets, and we've got universities again, and anybody that's interested to form teams and sort of challenge your skills. So.
Sounds like a lot of fun. How much does it cost?
For the three-day event, if you're staying non-residential, it's £40 a day. But on the last day, for Saturday, UK SEDS and the organisers are subsidising, thanks to our sponsors, so you only have to pay £10 to go if you're a student or young professional. So.
And if somebody wants to either get the more details or indeed book online, what's the best place to do that?
For the UK Space Conference, which is a three-day event, check out www.spaceconference.org.uk and you can download the registration pack. Or if you wish to go as a UK SEDS / student member, you don't have to be a UK SEDS member to come as a student. Check out our website, which is www.uk.ses.org, and there's a web link which you can go on and email us and download your registration form.
That's terrific, Alison. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. You're more than welcome.
Astronomy textbooks tell you that soon after the formation of the Earth, 4.5 billion years ago, the Earth experienced something that astronomers refer to as the period of bombardment. The craters of the moon, indeed the moon itself, are the consequences of that bombardment. As time progressed, the intensity of this bombardment declined and pretty much ended long before humans ever showed up on Earth. Incredibly, over a few days, in the middle of July 1994, it happened all over again, as 22 bits of comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 crashed into Jupiter, an event I witnessed firsthand. I happened to be in Tasmania that year. Not only was the sky clearer than that in Manchester, where I am normally based, but Jupiter was much higher in the sky. Along with Eugene and Caroline Shoemaker, David Levy discovered Shoemaker-Levy 9 in March 1993. And amazingly, it was orbiting a planet, Jupiter, not the Sun. It turned out that in 1992 it had already crossed the Roche limit and was thus doomed to impact on Jupiter. The Hubble Space Telescope, which had been promptly launched in 1990, was the perfect grandstand to record the biggest explosion that mankind had witnessed in the solar system. I spoke to David during his visit to Astrofest. Well, it's a pleasure to welcome David Levy to AstroTalk UK. David, you're here at
AstroTalk. It's really a pleasure to be here. I'm really honoured that you're interviewing me.
Oh, thank you very much indeed. You're here signing books. Which is your current book?
My newest one is My Guide to Observing Meteor Showers. And I got the inspiration for it when I woke up on a mostly cloudy morning of January the 3rd, 2006. I went outside, partly cloudy, mostly cloudy sky, expecting not to see anything. And over the course of the next hour, the sky began to clear a little bit, and I got 15 beautiful meteors.
15?
And I came in mostly cloudy conditions. and I came inside and I thought, what do you need to be inspired to write a book? Is it just 15 meteors? And I think, yeah. And so I wrote a letter to Cambridge, and I proposed it, and I think they accepted it the next day. And so within a week, I think I was writing it.
Right.
And I went through the whole year, from January to December, as meteor showers would come, I would write the chapter about that particular meteor shower.
If I just go back in history a little bit, perhaps to July 1994, that was a very special year for you.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I think the exciting thing about Shoemaker leaving 9 is that it wasn't a comet well known for what it was, as it was well known for what it did. And it its behavior in its dying moments was totally unpredictable and totally wonderful to be able to watch what it did.
How did you feel? Can you recall the feeling when you realized that really it was going to impact in Jupiter?
I was in shock, but not as much as Gene was, because he knew what it meant more than I did. Having spent his whole life studying impacts, he knew that what it would be like to witness one, and he was just beside himself.
Yeah. I know, sadly, Gene isn't with us anymore, yeah. But Carolyn, his wife, you still work with her regularly?
Yeah, for a number of years we were doing photographic searches together after Gene died. Then when my wife Wendy and I made the switch to modern electronic observing, Carolyn phased herself out, I'm afraid. I've tried to keep her into it, but I think she was more comfortable with the conventional photography.
Why do you think the demographic has changed? Why the majority of the amateur astronomers these days are older people?
Because I think we're failing to inspire the next generation to take up where we left off and to get into the field. Not as professional astronomers so much as just to enjoy the night sky. It's very difficult and challenging to do that with them, but I think we need to try.
What role do you think the modern technology of the internet and so on is partly
to blame? It's actually doing a good job taking kids away from the sky and putting them in front of their TV sets.
Yeah.
I remember an advertisement in Sky and Telescope years and years ago from a telescope company called Unitron. And it was very simple. It had a picture of a TV set turned off and a chair, an empty chair.
Uh-huh.
And the caption was, "Johnny isn't watching the late show tonight." And then they show a picture of him looking through a telescope. I think that was a wonderful ad.
Right.
I think that was the best ad in an astronomical magazine I've ever seen.
Are you optimistic about the development of amateur astronomy in the U.S.?
Well, I think England is very similar in that regard. England has a very good magazine, Astronomy Now, is a superb magazine, and I think that they're on the right track, but it's a massive undertaking. There's an opportunity next year, International Year of Astronomy. I don't know if that's going to work as well as they hope, but I think it's a good idea to try. And I think both England and the United States are areas where we need to try to get young people into astronomy. It's a very big challenge. In our generation, it was easy. We watched a launch to the moon.
Yeah.
and we didn't need to have astronomy in the classrooms. We had it. We lived it.
And it's ironic because today there's a spacecraft on its way to Mars, a couple of rovers on the ground, a couple of space probes in orbit around Mars, and yet there doesn't seem to be the enthusiasm in that age group that we had in our days.
I don't know why it's not there. I think maybe the culture has changed. People want more of an instant gratification. And astronomy is not instant gratification.
Mm-hmm.
It's something you need to nurture, take your time with. Although the spark can happen instantaneously just by going outside, seeing the space station, seeing a meteor, can get the spark going. But then after that comes the process of nurturing, which takes so long and it's a lot of effort.
To help with the meteor observing, your book on Guide to Observing Meteor Showers would be an ideal start.
Well, thank you. I hope so. It's something that I did just... this is my most recent book, and And I had a lot of fun working on it.
And what is the, you're working on next, the next book?
Next? I'd like to do a book on eclipses, a guide to observing eclipses, occultations, and transits.
And finally, you're doing a thesis.
Yes. And it's a thesis on the night sky in the time of Shakespeare. It's interdisciplinary, so because it takes up a very broad topic, I don't go into as much depth as is normally done at the doctoral level.
Well, it sounds like
which makes it very difficult to do and get approved.
But it's really good to see that you're bringing astronomy back into the human endeavor, which it really is.
Well, it is a human endeavor,
yeah.
And it is an endeavor for all of us. Spending so much time arguing about Pluto, I've got my own view about it, and it's a very personal one. I knew Clyde Tombaugh very, very well. We were very good friends, and I watched him suffer as he grew older when he kind of saw the writing on the wall regarding the status of his planet. He thought that his signature discovery was being taken from him, and so I have a very personal reason for wanting Pluto to stay a planet. But no matter what, Pluto is a very important object, very exciting to observe it and to study it.
I know you do a lot of writing these days, and of course you have your own podcast as well.
Yeah, it's Let's Talk Stars, and it's rather similar to yours. It's on the web at letstalkstars.com.
And it's a weekly. In addition to all that, do you still get to observe regularly?
Yes, every clear morning when there's no moon in the sky, I'm out for a couple of hours. What's better now, but before, is that in addition to doing my visual search for comets, I have 5 telescopes doing automated searches. So it's like there's a group of 6 of us out there.
All right, so you have 5 telescopes automatically scanning the skies.
It takes me about half an hour to get them all kicked up and going.
And they're fully automated.
Sometimes literally.
and are they all based in the U.S.?
Yeah, they're all in the one building.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
And which part of the U.S. are you from?
A little town of Vail, Arizona, near Tucson.
Oh, that's very warm.
It sounds so small, we have our own exit off the highway.
And how long are you here in the U.K. for, David?
Till Sunday. This is a very short trip.
Well, it's a pleasure to catch up with you, and thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to AstroTalk UK. AT UK is a non-profit project produced and recorded by Gurbir Singh. He nor any of the participants are paid for their contribution. AT UK's content is not validated against any authoritative source, and all the views and opinions are held by those who choose to express them. If you have a topic of interest you would like to discuss on AT UK, drop me a note, info@astrotalkuk.org.